Israel's war on Gaza, Vice President Kamala Harris, and the U.S. role in the ongoing genocide. I hope you all have a good and restful weekend.
Support comes from The Passenger Restaurant, located at 320 Main Street in Longmont, featuring an international tapas menu and more, available for dine-in and takeout services. Reservations or information on how to book a private event can be found at thepassenger.restaurant.
Support comes from Paradise Found Records, located at 1646 Pearl Street in downtown Boulder. Open from 11 to 7 daily, Boulder's source for vinyl and CDs, featuring a full inventory of turntables and Bluetooth speakers, and making house calls for collections. More information can be found at ParadiseFoundRecordsMusic.com.
Support comes from Myers Heating and Air Conditioning, serving Metro Boulder and the surrounding areas for over 57 years. Myers provides American Standard products, HVAC, and indoor air quality design services. More information at MyersHeatingAC.com.
Talk.
Talk show.
Talk back.
Talk radio. Walk your talk.
Talk your talk. KGNU talk.
Call in.
Call in and talk.
Call in and connect.
Connections.
Friday mornings at 8:30
on KGNU.
Good morning and welcome to Connections. I'm Joel Edelstein on a Friday morning at the very end of August. I hope you have enjoyed the summer and are getting ready for fall, which is feeling it this morning. It seems like fall is definitely on the way. Well, on Connections this morning, we're going to be mainly dealing with international affairs, the relations of the United States with other countries, but certainly how those relations affect the election coming up in just over about 65 days in November. I'm Joel Edelstein. My guest is Rob Prince, or co-host, really. Rob is professor at the University of Denver's Graduate School of International Studies, which changed its names a few years ago to the Corbell School of International Studies. Good morning, Rob.
Joel, can you hear me?
I can, certainly. Thank you.
Well, how do you like that? Anyhow, good morning to you, and good morning to the listeners. Nice to be back here on KGNU.
And I do want to, you have been involved in the Middle East since, I don't want to date you too much, but since the 1960s, when you were a Peace Corps volunteer.
Correct.
A great way to really get to integrate into an area of the world. You were not. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Wow. My whole teaching career and my ideas about the Middle East today were at least shaped by that experience. I was in the Peace Corps in Tunisia from 1966 to the beginning of 1969, approximately. I taught at the University of Tunis, an annex of the University of Tunis. And the really key thing here are just two elements, which I'll briefly mention. The first is that I was in North Africa during the 1967 Middle East War. So I saw that war not from New York City, where I was born and the big Jewish community there that I was part of, but from an Arab country. Granted, Tunisia is quite a distance from where the fighting was between Egypt, Israel, and Syria. But the whole country was mobilized at that time. Again, just briefly, I can only tell you that the way that I interpreted that war, having seen it from Tunisia, was very different from what my friends, families, politically left, right, or center, it really didn't matter, what they saw or how that war was spun to them. So that's the first thing. The second thing, which is might not sound relevant, but more and more in my mind it is during those years, I had the good fortune to travel to Algeria on vacations, really. But I was there three times. I probably was there over no more than about 6 weeks. But this was just after the Algerian Revolution. And you could still see the scars of what was really a horrific war of independence, which was fought there. Now, I mention that because more and more in my own mind, what I see transpiring between Israel and the Palestinians reminds me very, very much of the situation in Algeria between 1954 and 1962. I mention all that simply that when I left the Peace Corps, frankly, all I wanted to do was study what was it that I had seen and experienced, mostly in North Africa. But there's no way of talking about North Africa without talking about Israel-Palestine, U.S. policy, and things like that. So that's how it evolved.
You know, what you were saying about Algeria just touched a memory that I didn't even know I had, which was back in the 60s, that was still when you went to a movie theater to see a feature film, and before the feature film, you would have news clips of events going on in the world, and I can remember from that era, news clips of French soldiers attacking tents of independence. I don't know if they were even tents of independence fighters or just of civilian population, but it was looking at a massacre. The troops entered the tents and killed everybody in the tents. And, I mean, that was how many decades ago, but it's still imprinted in my mind. And somehow I think that may be relevant to the conflict going on now in Gaza as well. Well, we...
Yes, it is. Yeah. Go on, please.
So our topic today, we are going to talk about Gaza and Israel and the United States and Vice President Kamala Harris and the U.S. role in the region. But I wanted to, before we do that, I just finished reading a couple of fascinating blog posts that you have written on your personal blog about NATO, which is so relevant in terms of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and that we seem to see a shaping, a reshaping of the politics of the region in response to the Russian invasion. But you talk about NATO and Sweden and Finland, and those countries famous for their neutrality, that they, in fact, were not so neutral long, long before the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Yes. You know, I feel a little embarrassed. So first I'm talking about North Africa, and then I'm talking about the Nordic countries. But the fact of the matter is I spent 10 years of my life outside of the United States, five of them in Finland, and then much of the rest of the time in North Africa. But so what I want to note about that is the years in Finland were 1985 to about 1990. A whole family was there. And what impressed me about Finland in those days, so this is literally the period just before the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Gorbachev years in the Soviet Union, which had a great impact on what was happening in the Nordic countries. But at a certain point in time, I started to have this kind of sense of the situation of what I would call the soft belt in Europe between the more developed Western European countries, Germany, France, UK on the one hand, Soviet Union, Russia on the other. And, you know, these countries are kind of in the middle. And what you can say about these countries is they're in perpetual crisis, so to speak. And they're looking over their shoulder both ways, whether it's east or west. And literally, they're trying to figure out which way the wind's blowing politically. It's of course, ideology is always a factor in how they look at the world. But to a great degree, it's they don't want to antagonize, if you like, what seems to be the growing trend. So during the Cold War, frankly, the situation that Finland and Sweden in particular found themselves in, they benefited greatly from their neutrality. Now, the neutrality was partial. I mean, you know, the idea they were totally neutral is nonsense. They're both capitalist countries, social democratic countries, and part of, if you like, the European capitalist system. But they understood they needed to have, if you like, a business-like relationship with both sides of that Cold War. And nowhere did you see the success of that policy better than in Finland and Sweden. And just one quick example, during the years I was there, there was a recession, a generally European-wide global recession. Unemployment rates were skyrocketing in Western Europe, you know, after the first 30 or so years of the post-Cold War period, of the post-World War II period, excuse me. The unemployment rate in Finland when we were there was 1%. And the reason that they were able to get, to do so well was they compensated for the slowness in the markets that existed during that recession in Western Europe with their trade with Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. So they found themselves economically in this interesting position. And the political role that they played, a bridge between the East and the West, I found it fascinating. One last story about this. I could go on about this, but, you know, I'm used to, if you like, American politics, i.e. very conflictual, and it always has been. You know, there's nothing new. The intensity of it might be a little low. But I went to, early on in my experience there, I went to a meeting which had the breadth of Finnish politics there, from left to right. And it was an Oulu town above the Arctic Circle. In any case, I was ready for this big slugfest, you know, kind of Kamala Harris versus Trump or something, you know, or Reagan versus Mondale, whatever. And I am sitting there listening, and I don't hear any difference in foreign policy approaches from the most conservative to the most left-oriented radical parties that existed in Finland, where I'm sitting with my Finnish friend, and he's saying, "Isn't this exciting? Didn't you see all the differences?" And I mention that because there was a consensus in Finland on foreign policy, on this whole notion of neutrality. So that is what has broken down. Now, why and how it has broken down, I just, it's hard to, you know, kind of see it from Denver, so to speak, where I am. But there's some elements of it. Some of it simply has to do with once the Soviet Union collapsed, where was the future economically of these Nordic countries? Well, obviously, it was more in the West with the United States and Western Europe. So that's one element of it. But it really took this 33 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union to kind of work the Finnish and Swedish populations to such an extent that they would join NATO and change their position from this neutral position with all of its benefits to literally being not just a part, if you like, of the NATO configuration, but literally on the front lines. So the whole situation in the country has shifted considerably.
And do you see this as influencing Putin and Russia's decisions regarding Ukraine?
to a very modest degree. When I look at, when you look more closely, of course, Ukraine is so close to Russia and had been part of Russia. Finland actually had been a Russian colony for 100 years. So there's that connection. But the more I look at it, the less that analogy holds up. Ukraine was literally a part of the Soviet Union. The Russian population there is significant. All that history. And for modern day Russia, Ukraine is a far more strategically significant place than Finland or Sweden. But having said that, there's another point here, and that is, until this Finland and Sweden joined NATO, I'm not saying that the relations between the two countries were great, but they were civil. And from a strategic point of view, let's take this a little further. What would happen really if Finland and Sweden, if through Finland and Sweden, that NATO attacked Russia? They wouldn't last for more than a week. My hunch is it would even be less than that. So I don't see it at this point of being similar, so to speak, in terms of the possible tension. The disturbing factor, which is what I wrote about in those blogs you read, is in the past year, 35 new U.S. military bases throughout the Nordic countries. Norway has some new ones, Sweden and Finland. And the thing about these military bases that are in Sweden and Finland, number one, they follow the same principle as like the base in Okinawa, i.e., they're considered literally almost U.S. sovereign territory. What goes in and out of those bases, Finland has nothing, has no say in it. Now, that does not indicate that there are going to be nuclear weapons there, but there's a chance that there might be. And that if that kind of thing emerges, we're looking at a vastly different situation. So I don't see it changing the, if you like, the equation that much. It just adds to the tension, just makes Europe that much more of a polarized place.
Very good. Thanks for that, Rob. And in terms of the impact of NATO on Russia's decision to invade Ukraine, I think we've said what we're going to say about that for this morning, and I'd like to shift our geographic focus now and come back to the United States and to the Democratic candidate for president, Kamala Harris. And it's significant, I think, that people have been, and analysts have been saying now for just most of the time since Kamala Harris became the Democratic nominee, the Democratic candidate, she has not given depth interviews. She has not kind of had the exposure that's involved in that kind of depth interview. And yesterday she did. That is, she was interviewed by CNN. And this is her first interview really as the presidential nominee. Of course, she was asked about Israel and Gaza and Palestine. And her response to that, it's I've like to read a little bit of it because it's kind of hard to capture outside of being very literal. She said, when asked, "Let me be very clear, I'm unequivocal in Israel's right to defend itself, and that's not going to change. But let's take a step back," she said. "On October 7, 1,200 people were massacred, many young people who were simply attending a music festival. Women were horribly raped, She said, again affirming Hamas' use of gender-based and sexual violence during October 7, a fact that has been subject to skepticism and conspiracy on the left. But she says, looking at Tim Walz's silence on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Jews who vote for Trump should have, I've got to get my quote right here. As I said then, and I say today, Israel has a right to defend itself. We would, and how it does so matters, she continued. Far too many innocent Palestinians have been killed, and we have got to get a deal done. We were in Doha. We have to get a deal done. This war must end in the meantime, and we must get a deal that is about getting the hostages out. I've met with the families of the American hostages. Let's get the hostages out. Let's get the ceasefire done, Harris added. Well, then CNN's Dana Bash again asked if this meant there would be a change in policy. And I know I'm kind of laboring on this, but I do think it's important because Kamala Harris may be the next president. Whether there would be a change in policy under the Harris-Walz administration. And she responds, no, we have to get a deal done, Dana. We have to get a deal done. And she goes on and says the same thing over and over again.
Yes.
You know, and she says, I remain committed since I've been on October 8th to what we must do to work toward a two-state solution where Israel is secure and in equal measure the Palestinians have security and self-determination and dignity. So that's something that I don't think that Joe Biden ever said, but neither of them has backed it up with any actions. None of what's come out of the White House or come from Kamala Harris has influenced the flow of weapons. Most recently, $20 billion additional weapons dollars approved for Israel. And what do we do with this? What is Kamala Harris saying here? What can we, with confidence, read in her comments?
There's so many things to answer here. I don't know where to begin. But let me begin by saying that in preparing for our program this morning, I read the same article. Okay. And so it's been on my mind. There are a number of points. So what I'll do is I'll just make a couple comments. If you think that I'm going in the wrong direction or there's some place you want me to, shift, let me know. But first, in terms of how she frames the whole conflict, it's something we've been seeing for some time, Joel, and that is that it's as if history begins in the Middle East on October 7th. All right. And of course, if you begin on October 7th and you begin with whatever you want to call it, Hamas's breakout from Gaza, the attack on Israel, you have a certain view of the situation. I won't come back to that because there are some exaggerations there. But of course, the main point here is it forgets 75 years, actually more than that, of history. Of Israel, of the Nakba in 48, of the different wars, of the occupation, i.e. there is a little bit of history, to put it mildly, explaining, not justifying, but certainly explaining why the situation has degenerated into basically armed struggle and guerrilla warfare. All right, so that's, that's the first point. In terms of some of the things that happened, look, there's no way to, and I wouldn't even try to prettify what happened on October 7th. However, some of the charges have proved to be either questionable or completely spurious. And one of them, and it's come out in the last several days, is the notion of babies being beheaded and women being raped. There's no evidence for it, none. And this has been reported in a number of places, although the interesting thing here is even though it's been seriously challenged, these accusations, the Biden administration, and that's both Biden himself and Kamala Harris, continue to use this false narrative of Hamas raping all these women. So there's that point. In terms of the two-state solution, I am someone who have supported the two-state solution going back to 1967. Why? Because there's an international consensus around it, that it comes out of the United Nations, both its Security Council resolutions and General Assembly resolutions. They've been very clear about it. Today, what I can say, and I'm really saddened about this, is that the diplomatic efforts to solve this this crisis have failed. And we're talking here about Camp David in the late 1970s, and then, of course, the Oslo Accords. And when we look at what happened in these two major diplomatic initiatives, basically, the occupation, the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza grew stronger. I mean, I remember when I first was kind of horrified that there were 200,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank and Gaza. Now the number, I think, is something like 800,000. All right. So what are these two big negotiating processes done to resolve this conflict? Nothing. In fact, they've only intensified it. And I think that there was something else going on, which is a little bit complicated, but worth discussing. And that was, if you look at these two initiatives and then what the United States and Israel is trying to do today, it's basically they want a settlement with the countries in the Middle East. They do. But without resolving the Palestinian conflict. That's really the heart of both Camp David and Oslo. We'd like to solve these problems, but no, we can't deal with Palestine. So we're seeing that once again in this this new normalization initiative that took place during the Trump years, for Israel and the Saudis and UAE and countries and Jordan and Egypt to normalize their contacts. And basically, from a geopolitical point of view, what October 7th did is it blew that whole process of normalization without Palestine out of the water completely. So there's all that. Final point on this is, trying to study this as well as I can as it's evolving. The fact of the matter is, I don't see, to me, there's the differences between what a Trump administration and a Kamala Harris administration would be doing on Israel and Palestine is negligible. It's the same policy, slight differences. So I don't see any change. And one of the things that Kamala Harris has said is, well, she's talked to Palestinians, quote, privately. I cannot tell you, that resonated with me. Because I cannot tell you the number of times that I have spoken in person with members of Congress from here in Colorado, senators and representatives, whatever, where what they say in private is encouraging and hopeful, and what they do in public is quite, they vote for more arms for Israel or whatever. So I see this, I see the comments that she has made in private as not, they don't have much weight as far as I'm concerned. And what I look at more carefully in this kind of watch what I do and not so much what I say is what you talked about earlier, the new major, whatever it is, $18, $20 billion worth of new weapons to Israel. There are some statistics or some facts coming out that since October 7th, there have been 500 plane loads of weapons from the United States to Israel and something like 100 shiploads. So if we contrast, we want to help those poor Palestinian civilians because there's some of that come out. It's pretty obvious that continuing to arm Israel to the degree suggests that U.S. policy in Israel is, despite all the protests or whatever, remains the same.
And I want to
go on.
I want to pick up on that in just a minute, because it's not clear that within the United States there has not been some change, and particularly in the Democratic Party. But I'd like to just break to say it is 9 o'clock here at KGNU. You're listening to this conversation at KGNU Boulder and Denver. And I'm Joel Edelstein, talking with Rob Prince from the University of Denver's Corbell School of International Studies. If you're interested in what's happening, if you're concerned about what's happening in Palestine, then you probably would like to know that the Boulder-Nablus Sister City Project is holding a fundraiser on September 7th at the First United Methodist Church in Boulder. It's to raise money to outfit a medical clinic in the Oscar refugee camp. And the Boulder-Nablus Sister City Project has successfully completed its fundraising, which I think was $50,000 for an ambulance that has now actually arrived at the Oscar refugee camp and is in use, which is good because that area is currently under attack by the Israeli Defense Force. Medical care is more important than ever. On September 7th, there'll be an evening to celebrate Palestine. The Boulder-Nablus Sister City Project is selling tickets at boulder.nablus.org/celebrate-palestine-fundraiser, celebrate-palestine-fundraiser. You can help to raise $100,000 for medical equipment and supplies for the Oscar refugee camp in Nablus. There'll be live music, Palestinian food, as well as a silent auction. And that's coming up, gosh, it's going to be a week from tomorrow. And you can be there on September 7th. Well, what I was referring to before the break, Rob, is that the base of the Democratic Party seems to have shifted regarding Palestine. The decision by the Democratic National Convention to not have a single Palestinian or Palestinian American speak from the stage is not really representative of where Democrats are today. How do you see that?
I agree with you. There's a long history that I've, again, living here for so long, I've seen, where the base of the Democratic Party in Colorado, and I think it reflects what's going on nationally, is far more, call it whatever term you want, progressive, left-oriented, than the leadership. So on this issue alone, almost a decade ago, there was a statewide Democratic Party convention in which the question of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, the occupied territories, was picked up. It passed overwhelmingly, and then no one ever heard about it again. So and I found that very interesting, because at the time I thought, oh my gosh, we're going to raise this supporters of Palestine, critics of Israel, we're going to raise this in the Democratic Party, we're going to get blown out of the water. That didn't happen at all. So when we raised it within the context of what was going on at that time for a change in U.S. policy and for respect for a two-state solution in which the Palestinians were, it passed by a big margin. But then the leadership of the party basically buried it somewhere. We never heard about it. It never made any news. And so I've seen that kind of trend for a really long time, and it's playing out nationally as well. The base of the Democratic Party and its positions, I identify with a lot of it. But but it basically gets smothered. And you can see this kind of, I don't know what to call it, but almost contempt that the leadership of the party has for its own program, it's not bad it hasn't been on Israel and Palestine. So something is going on there. Now, what that means in terms of, what could happen in a Kamala Harris presidency, I don't see it meaning that much, unfortunately, at all. And here, I think, the leadership really of both parties, they see the same thing, more or less, and it's this. Foreign policy is not really an important issue in many presidential elections. There are exceptions. We can talk about 68. We don't have to go back that far at all. 2000, well, when Obama got elected, the Iraq War was a big part of that. But for the most part, foreign policy issues I'm not saying they don't count, but they're pretty insignificant for the most part in presidential elections. Now we have, in some sense, we see the same thing. What's different about this? What's different about this is that according to international organizations, the International Court of Justice, et cetera, Israel's committing a genocide. And so it's not just a little foreign policy issue we're dealing with. We're dealing with something much bigger, much darker. And the question I have is, will this be a presidential issue? And I know that there are elements, and I have to admit I'm part of it, trying to make it one of the issues, but I'm not sure that it's going, how far that's going to go. And there was just a new CNN poll, which basically said that 60% of the American people support the Biden administration's policy of arming Israel right now. This is after whatever we have now, 10, 11 months of what amounts to a genocide in Gaza. So, from where I'm sitting, those of us who are concerned about this, we have to keep pushing that this become a part of the presidential debate. It's not only about the Middle East. What's going on in Gaza is a reflection of a much, much deeper cavern, almost, or a gulf that's being built between one part of the world and the other. And how it is going to be resolved is going to affect not just the future of Gaza and Israel, but I'm convinced will have much broader implications for the world.
And I'd like to follow up by looking at some of the impacts of the situation, the attack on Gaza by Israel, impacts on both Israel and on the Palestinians. But before that, let's go to the phones. I'd like to welcome, and we are at 303-442-4242. I'd like to welcome Lynn to KGNU. Good morning, Lynn. Good morning. I'm not sure. Lynn, are you there? Lynn, are you there? Well, I don't know why we're not getting Lynn. The phone system says that we should. Well, let's go to another caller. Good morning. You're on KGNU.
Good morning. I have written to my senators, Bennett and Hickenlooper, and to the president about Israel and Gaza. And they have all used the same phrase that Kamala Harris used. Israel has a right to defend itself. And there's something in there that is mysterious, and why is that the same phrase that everybody uses? And where did it come from? And why are we so married to it? Why don't they look at what's really happening? Polio, dead people. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I think you make a very good point. I suspect that the phrase is attractive because I think on the face of it, everybody's got a right to defend themselves. Every state, anyway, has a right to defend itself. The question that one might ask then is, don't the Palestinians have a right to defend themselves? And
exactly.
That's not what the international community has been saying, and what makes Palestinians different from everybody else.
But why? Why is that true? Why is it okay for them to be in apartheid, but not for Africa? Why is it okay for them to be locked up and in a prison, essentially outdoors, and it's not okay anywhere else? That makes no sense.
Yeah, I think you're certainly right about that. And the reason that international law has not been applied to Israel has been because at root, international law does require that political power be on the side of the law. And in the case of Israel, that has not been the case because the major political power is the United States, and the U.S. has shielded Israel from international law these 75 years. And that may well be breaking down now. That's what we see with the International Court of Justice saying that both the Hamas and Israel, including Netanyahu, are guilty of war crimes. And that's something new.
But so is Joe Biden. So is the whole United States because of our stance.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, everybody's saying Joe Biden's going to be some great guy because he stepped down. But he's a war criminal, just like Netanyahu.
That's right, and so are you and me.
Exactly. And that's not what I voted any of them into office to do. And I've told all of them I would do everything I can to get them out of office.
And how do you deal with the our two-party system and the alternative if it's not the Democrats?
Well, that's the bind, isn't it? That's the bind.
Mm-hmm. I guess we're not going to solve
evil,
that one
it's an, yeah, it's an
this
evil
morning.
System, all the way around, yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. We are at 303-442-4242. We're kind of managing the phone system without the benefit of Nancy, who does that so well, who is not able to play that role this morning. And so we're doing our best to manage the phones. So if nobody's picking up and you're calling and it's ringing, just let it ring. We'll get to you when we can. Good morning. You're on KGNU.
Good morning, Joel and Rob. This is Arnie Carter calling from Boulder. I mean, from Denver.
Welcome.
And I called last week and I was talking about like the Blue MAGA movement. You kind of responded, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that it was more just some individuals in the Democratic Party that are kind of moving this Blue MAGA thing along and dehumanizing Palestinians. And I would just like to say that, you know, it comes from the top. It comes from the top of the Democratic Party. It comes from Kamala Harris. comes from the Senate. And again, to reiterate that although the Republican Party is disgusting and repugnant, so is the Democratic Party. And I'll let you go ahead and comment on that, Joel. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Artie. Well, so it's not the base that's running things. And I think that that's true. I'm not sure if I've got anything to add to it. And I must say, because of issues with the phones, I'm trying to get Rob Prince back on the line to participate. Let's see. Rob, do we have you? Rob, do we have you?
This is John.
Hello?
Hello, this is John Hankel.
Yes,
from Boulder.
John. Would you hold, John, and I'll get back to you? I'm trying to get Rob back. Rob, do we have you?
No, this is Lynn.
Oh, okay, Lynn, well, I was trying to get you before, so I'm glad that I found you now. Welcome to KGNU. Yes, you're on the air.
Okay. This is the deal. Okay. Kamala says she wants a deal. Okay. Does she want reparations?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay. Does she want reparations?
Does she want right of return? Does she want the settlers out? Does she want defunding?
Does she want reparations?
Does she want equal rights?
Well, I think that she's made it clear, or it would seem, that she is saying fundamentally she wants a continuity of policy before any of those things.
Well, I think that she's made it clear.
And I don't know why we're getting repeats on our phone system.
Continuity of policy, yeah. She wants more of the same. That's pretty clear.
Yes.
So, Jill Stein. It's very simple. Jill Stein. I voted for Biden. Never again. You know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Lynn.
She can't even say what her deal is. She says, we're making a deal, a backdoor deal. I know what her deal's about.
Okay, thank you, Lynn. Good morning, you're on KGNU.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yes.
I'm calling because I keep getting emails from Diana DeGette, and one of them said that she was rather proud of herself because she didn't censor Rashida Tlaib because she believes in free speech, but Rashida was wrong, and she didn't specify what she was wrong about. And I realized that I could reply to that email. And I told her that, and she said it was the same old story that Rashida Tlaib was espousing. And I said, actually, it's the same old story that when people complain about genocide, they're accused of anti-Semitism, and being against a genocide is not anti-Semitic. So I think it's interesting that when you get those blanket emails, you can reply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, we don't know if they have the staff to to really respond when you do reply. Have you had anything come back your way?
No.
Well, hopefully it registers, even if they are unable to really respond.
Right. That's what I'm hoping, because I've called them all, and that doesn't really do any good, it seems. But anyway, thank you for this program.
Great. Thanks for your call. And we are at 303-442-4242, and I say that with a bit of trepidation in that our phone system is being very problematic this morning, and I'm afraid that I have been rude to people quite unintentionally, and I'm not really able to control it very well, but let's go back and give it another try. Good morning. You're on KGNU. Hello? Yes, I think you're on. Well, Good morning. You're on KGNU.
Joel, it's yes. Rob. I just got back in. I've been trying for the last 15 minutes.
Yeah, this is...
I don't know what happened.
This is definitely not a stellar moment for the technical side of KGNU. There's no two ways about
all right.
That.
All right. Well, I don't know what folks said, so I don't know how to comment on it. I'm not sure how to proceed. I'll leave it to you. You're better at these.
I think that basically the balance of calls were one that Kamala Harris and the Democrats do not seem to be providing anything but continuity with the Biden policy, and that whatever the base thinks of, the Democratic base thinks about this, the leadership is sticking with that continuity, and
okay.
We'll see where that goes. Where I'd like to go is to note, I think, I'm not sure if everybody is aware of the extent to which Gaza has been rendered an unlivable place.
Oh,
with the assault by particularly the Israeli Air Force, although tanks have certainly done their job of destroying buildings, destroying housing, destroying all of the universities, destroying most of the hospitals and making them unworkable. Cultural institutions, aside from of over 40,000 people outright killed, not counting those who we don't find, but they're under the rubble, their bodies decomposing, that it's a toll that is just enormous. And when we look at the Israeli side, the death toll has been certainly compared with what the Palestinians have experienced, the death toll has not been great among Israelis, although anybody who's killed in a war is a death to be regretted. And particularly that it's not often there's a war which you can actually find a good reason for happening, and this is not one of them. What is happening in Israeli society is and the politics of Israel is really extraordinary. That
yes.
Israel used to have a democracy, and currently that's simply not the case. The government has been captured by a narrow segment of the right wing. I think that probably at least half of the Israeli population is not engaging and is not counting politically. They're not contesting the right. And that right keeps getting more and more and more extreme. And I'm looking at some of the reports on, for example, the new police commissioner, Danny Levy.
Yeah.
I mean, he was appointed by the National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, and they are fascists, and unapologetically so, and Jewish supremacists who are trying to stir up, and they're supporting the beyond harassment of people, of Palestinians in the West Bank, and the death toll there, but the instability to the whole region because of Jewish settlers who are attacking people. Here's a quote from, let me see. You know, a quote from Shin Bet, the security services chief, declaring that Jewish terrorism can cause indescribable damage to Israel. The Israeli army issued a similar warning on Thursday, saying that it endangers the security of the West Bank and that too few settlement leaders are doing their part to prevent riots and violence against Palestinians. And if you just kind of look through the pages of Haaretz, Israel's oldest newspaper, you can see the accounts of what Jewish terrorists are doing to Palestinians on a daily basis and have been for months. And the Israeli government, which has a responsibility to protect the Palestinians, is doing nothing of the sort. And this represents a deterioration of the situation in terms of democracy and human rights in Israel that's pretty extreme.
You know, can I just make one? I guess we're coming to the end here, Joel, and I agree with what you've just said. I just want to add, to kind of put it in context, the real question for me is, can there be a negotiated peace settlement to this conflict? And more, it looks like the answer to that is no, that it's going to be decided on the battlefield. And I really regret that. I'd like to believe that diplomacy can win over war, but it doesn't look like that's it. I don't see it any other way right now. So that's point one. Point two, this is not simply an Israeli war. The idea of separating Israel's policy from that of the Biden administration and or the Trump administration, that's not true. From where I'm sitting. So whatever it is that Israel is doing to Palestine, it has the support and the coordination with Washington. This is a U.S. Israeli war against the Palestinians, and I don't see. I'd like to believe it's going to happen. You know, maybe we'll see it. But should Kamala Harris win, I don't. Those callers who said that I don't see a change in policy. And all that means is peace movement, peace-oriented people. We have a lot of work to do, and we just got to keep at it.
Yeah, and within Israel, the economy is beginning to fail. The bases for the economy. And it may be that becomes more decisive in bringing about an end to this conflict than any kind of diplomacy.
Yes, the number of people that have left Israel, again, it's very hard to get an exact figure. A week ago, the figure I heard was 1 million out of 8 million. There are some sources that suggest it's even higher than that. So Israel is bleeding, and what you said about the economy just scratching the surface, it's in real bad trouble. And the bottom line here is that, you know, what Israel has always claimed.
We've only got a few seconds, Ron.
Yep. Okay. Then we'll leave it. This is not a safe place for not only for Palestinians, but for Jews anymore.
Rob Prince, thanks so much for joining me on Connections. Thanks to our callers. I'm sorry for the mishandling of the calls this morning. We'll try to have that not happen again, that's for sure.
Thank you. Thank you, Gerald. Bye-bye.
And September 7th at the First United Methodist Church in Boulder is the Boulder Novelist Sister City Project fundraiser to provide medical supplies and equipment for the Oscar refugee camp, which certainly is in need of medical help. It's under assault by the Israeli Defense Force. I'm Joel Edelstein. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you'll stay tuned for the Morning Sound Alternative.
Talk.
Talk show.
Talk back.
Talk radio. Walk your talk.
Talk your talk. KGNU Talk.
Call in.
Call in and talk.
Call in and connect.
Connections.
Friday mornings at 8:30
on KGNU.
Well, good morning. It's 9:30. It's a Friday morning. It's time for the Morning Sound Alternative. This is Dave McIntyre here with you this morning. And we'll be here until noon playing some tunes, letting you know about things that are going on, giving away some tickets, and we'll have some guests in the studio a little later on this morning. So stick around for all that. Let's start off with one a brand new